This is an MP3 audio clip from the weekly People First radio broadcast.
CHLY 101.7 FM, Vancouver Island. On the web, www.chly.ca.
AIDS 2010, the international conference on AIDS that is underway this week in Vienna, Austria, highlights the critical connection between human rights and HIV, a dialogue begun in earnest during a similar conference in Mexico City in 2008. AIDS 2010 also coincides with a major international push for extended access to HIV prevention, treatment, care, and support. We're joined on the phone by Heidi Exner, who is a manager of health promotion and community development with AIDS Vancouver Island. Welcome to People First Radio, Heidi.
Thank you for having me.
In his opening remarks at the start of AIDS 2010 in Vienna, Dr. Julio Montaner, he is the president of the International AIDS Society, he said, "The theme of AIDS 2010, rights here, right now, was chosen to emphasize the critical and fundamental connection between human rights and HIV. There can be no end to the pandemic unless we secure full protection of human rights for those most vulnerable to HIV and AIDS." Tell us more about the human rights approach to HIV and AIDS and why it's so important.
Well, HIV can't survive in a world where human rights are fully recognized. So what I mean by that is that in most communities where people experience high risk for HIV and also may die more quickly of HIV and AIDS are usually places where things like homophobia, heterosexism, transphobia, racism and colonialism, gender-based violence, poverty, lack of education, lack of access to health care, misunderstanding about addictions and mental health, all of these things are factors that affect human rights and their human rights issues. And HIV thrives in conditions where human rights are violated.
Now, Meena Saraswati Seshu, who represents a group in India called Sangram that works with rural women and men involved in prostitution and sex work, delivered what is called the Jonathan Mann Memorial Lecture at AIDS 2010. And she said the following, and I'm quoting this, Heidi, "The phrase rights-based approach flows easily into the speaking points and materials of many organizations and even governments when they talk about meeting the challenge of HIV. This is a good thing if the phrase really means something. But I'm concerned that, quote-unquote, rights-based approach loses its meaning when people think that it's a matter of just inviting affected people to a meeting or speaking kindly of them or even just dropping the phrase rights-based into a mission statement." Heidi, tell us more about the challenges involved in this and what are some of the challenges AIDS Vancouver Island has faced?
Well, I think that it's very easy to give lip service to human rights. Everybody believes in human rights. It's very different to put it into practice because when we talk about creating real human rights on the ground, it means taking a stand about issues that make most people extremely uncomfortable and there's not a lot of safety for them to talk about it or act on it. So I think for us what that means is making sure that when we're giving service in the community for folks living with HIV, for folks who are vulnerable to HIV, we're giving it in a way that means something to them. And so, for instance, we're not just saying, oh, we'll do a workshop on HIV prevention. We're delivering the workshop to the community that needs it in a way that they can get it, right? So access is very important. And access is about more than just saying we're going to do this. It's about making it happen in a way that people can actually get to.
Research conducted in British Columbia about the effectiveness of HART, highly active antiretroviral therapy, was made public on Sunday at AIDS 2010. The United Nations HIV/AIDS program director hailed the research and said the results mean the UN is embracing HART as the fundamental worldwide prevention strategy for AIDS. Highly active antiretroviral therapy. Tell us more about HART.
Well, to put it very simply, HART is basically birth control for viral replication. So the only thing it does is once somebody is taking it regularly and as they're supposed to, which can be a challenge, right, depending on your circumstances, if you're taking it properly, it's like birth control for the virus. So all it does is it stops the virus from reproducing in infected cells. But it can't cure someone And it can't necessarily always prevent transmission. But what it can do if someone's taking it and they're not infected is if HIV enters their body, it can help kind of stop gap the virus from reproducing so quickly that it becomes a very chronic infection. So it can have preventative qualities, but it can also help people living with HIV live a more healthy and long-lived life.
Related to Vancouver Island, what have you seen and heard on the island?
Related to heart therapy?
Yes.
So the number of people that need access to HIV treatment greatly outnumbers the number of people who are getting it, for one. And that's fairly common across the country. Like, we need to build in more places and more access to the medication for everybody that needs it, for one. And for the other, we're just playing a minor role on the island, but an important one in this particular study, where there are locations where we're starting to roll out the seek and treat method, which is where we're looking for people who need HIV treatment. We're giving it to them. And in terms of giving it to people as a preventative measure, that's very, very limited here right now. In terms of taking part in that research part of it. But in other parts of the province, it is, especially in the northern regions of BC and the lower Vancouver regions where there's really hotbeds of HIV infection, it's more pronounced in terms of how that program is growing.
Heidi, tell us a little more about Seek and Treat.
So Seek and Treat is kind of the foundation of the HIV, the heart kind of push that Dr. Montaner is kind of speaking to. What the attempt is to try and find people that need the treatment, get them on treatment for two reasons. One, if they're infected, which is who they're kind of aiming for first, if they're on treatment, they're less likely to pass the virus on to someone else because the numbers of virus in their blood and sex fluid should be much, much lower than someone who's not on treatment. So for one, if they expose someone to the virus, they're less likely to infect them. And for another, when they're on the treatment, they're much more likely to have a general increase in quality of life and just have a longer life and healthier life overall. So there's lots of reasons to do this, but those are the two main ones.
Heidi, we just have a moment left in our discussion today. Is there anything else you'd like to add to our conversation?
Yeah, I'd say that probably the biggest challenge that we experience in trying to, you know, change the tide of HIV in our communities and globally remains the effect of stigma and discrimination. So when people don't feel safe talking about this, when people don't feel safe protecting themselves, when people don't know where to get a test because it doesn't look good to ask for a test, you know, those kinds of little things are very big things, and they speak to the silence that still exists around this virus. So I think that the more we can educate ourselves about the facts and the more we can talk about it, that's what's going to slow the tide of this, in addition to initiatives like Seek and Treat or, you know, what's happening at the conferences. That's what it's really about, is ending the silence on it and creating a way in for people that's safe and meaningful.
Thank you so much for taking the time to join us today, Heidi. It was very much appreciated.
Thanks for the interview. I appreciate it.
Heidi Exner is the Manager of Health Promotion and Community Development at AIDS Vancouver Island.
You're listening to People First Radio. I'm Kevin. I'm here with Ashta today, Dr. Julio Montaner, who is the director of the British Columbia Center for Excellence in HIV and AIDS and the current president of the International AIDS Society, called on delegates to the AIDS 2010 conference being held in Vienna this week to stand up and be heard. He said that the Vienna conference marks the beginning of the end of discrimination, stigma, and the global HIV/AIDS epidemic. Canadian AIDS activist Ralph Juergens was one of the presenters at the conference. He spoke about people who use drugs, HIV, and human rights in a presentation given earlier in the week.
Ralph Juergens is one of the co-founders of the Canadian HIV/AIDS Legal Network and was its executive director between 1998 and 2004. But most recently, he shot to fame as a senior advisor to the executive director of the Global Fund. He's received many Canadian and international awards for his contribution in the fight against HIV for human rights, and he's going to talk to us today about people who use drugs, HIV, and human rights. Ralph Juergens.
Thank you very much. I'd also like to acknowledge the series gurus and the editors and my co-authors, Joanne Chetta, Joe Amon, Steve Barrell, and Chris Bayer, and a few other people who contributed either directly to this research or through their previous work. I'd also like to acknowledge the many people who use drugs who participated in the research that I will be presenting. And I would like to dedicate this presentation to the hundreds of thousands of people who use drugs who are in prisons and pretrial detention centers worldwide without receiving adequate care, treatment, and support. We reviewed the evidence from more than 900 reports and studies, and we looked at the following questions. First, do drug laws, policies, or practices violate the human rights of people who use drugs? Do they increase vulnerability to HIV or HIV-related risk behaviors? Or do they otherwise compromise the health of people who use drugs or the communities in which they live? And we also reviewed the evidence about what works, which initiatives, which programs support the effectiveness of services for people who use drugs and also reduce abuses of their human rights. Now, as a little bit of a background, until the mid-1990s, there was very little attention given to human rights in drug research, and drug use was also very rarely mentioned in the human rights world. This has changed in recent years. There's an increasing number of studies. As I said, we were able to review over 900 of reports and studies that document human rights violations of people who use drugs, that document their negative outcomes for health and other human rights of people who use drugs, and also document how programs and interventions and policy changes can improve both the human rights situation as well as the outcome of interventions. What was the result of the review? We were able to document very serious human rights violations against people who use drugs worldwide, ranging from denial of harm reduction services and effective treatment, and you have heard about this by the previous presenters, discrimination and access to antiretroviral treatment, which Daniel Wolf talked about. And a number of human rights violations ranging from police harassment, arbitrary detention, ill-treatment, and torture, ranging from extreme situations such as the Thai war on drugs, which was meant to target allegedly drug traffickers, but resulted in the death of over 2,200 people, many of whom were not even people who used drugs. We also have an increasing number of studies documenting what police presence does to the effectiveness of needle exchange programs, users staying away from these services because of police presence. A number of countries has the death penalty, often for minor offenses such as drug possession. Now, international human rights law does not prohibit the death penalty per se, but the death penalty can only be imposed for serious crimes, and in fact, it is not reserved only for such crimes. As I said, hundreds of thousands of people who use drugs are in prisons or in pretrial detention, often simply for using drugs or possessing drugs, and in most prison settings worldwide, there's a lack of access to prevention and treatment. And we've heard at this conference a number of good examples, such as yesterday in Spain, and I'm pleased to see Dr. Zulaika from Spain in the audience, who was one of the first people to document the effectiveness of needle exchange programs in prisons. But such services are not available to the vast majority of prisoners in prisons worldwide. Daniel already talked about the coercive and abusive treatment in drug detention centers that we're seeing an increasing number, particularly in Asia. Information and services are often denied to youth under the age of 18, and we've heard from youth at this conference talking about the impact that has on them, and we also are seeing increased HIV rates among people who are denied such services, and women face similar barriers. Also, because of drug policies, restrictive drug policies, people who are suffering from other medical conditions such as cancer are denied adequate pain relief and die in big pain. What works in terms of practical programs or initiatives that support effectiveness of services and at the same time lead to reduced human rights abuses? I can only go very briefly into this, but there is a number of studies that have looked at the effectiveness of harm reduction training for police officers, judges, and prosecutors, showing good results. Legal services provided to people who use drugs in an increasing number of countries, such as Ukraine and elsewhere, have shown that this leads to people being less incarcerated and more willing to take on cases when police, for example, denies them access to harm reduction services. Finally, there's also an increasing number of studies clearly demonstrating the positive effect of meaningful participation of people who use drugs. Now, there are, under international human rights law, situations in which some rights may be limited, but the measures that I have just talked about are entirely disproportionate, ineffective, and cannot be justified. In particular, we know that drug policies do not lead to reduced drug use. So governments have good public health reasons to ensure that laws, policies, and practices do not contribute to the spread of HIV, but they also have a legal obligation to act. The right to health, in fact, requires countries to have an effective, rational, comprehensive harm reduction policy and plan. And providing NSPs, OST, antiretroviral treatment, is not enough. As Stephanie and my other colleagues have shown, it is the importance of a supportive environment, including protective laws, is clearly demonstrated. We do need to continue increasing the evidence base on these issues, but we do know that there is already a lot of evidence, and we do know that, for example, the risk is not limited to the moment of injection with a contaminated needle, but can begin minutes earlier when a police officer confiscates a sterile needle from a user. So the call is really for researchers to look at this. In terms of conclusions and future directions, it is very important to state clearly and strongly up front that these reported abuses are abhorrent in themselves and must be combated for that reason alone. But many of these abuses also have now demonstratedly a negative effect on the health of people who use drugs and the communities in which they live. And that is an additional reason to fight against these abuses. It is useful to join human rights law with public health evidence, and we're hoping that this may allow us to help shift responses to drug control away from failed emphasis on prohibition to a more rational health promotion framework. Reform of drug laws and policies is clearly indicated, and again we have heard from Stephanie and others about the impact that removal of laws that, for example, restrict access to substitution therapy could have. Decriminalization of drugs for personal use and possession of drugs is now evidence-based policy. We have clear evidence of the positive effect of decriminalization. Human rights programming is important to include as part of every national response to drug use and HIV. And finally, we also need to reform international drug policy and policymaking strategies. Now, this is the first conference under a human rights theme, and it's also a conference that has a focus on drug use and HIV and on Eastern Europe, one of the regions of the world that is still showing an increase in new infections. Now, our hope is that human rights activists and scientists will work together using science and human rights jointly for advocacy, and let's move from rhetoric to real programmatic action on human rights. And one thing that I would like to ask all of you is to join us, authors of this series, tonight at the first ever March for Human Rights at an international AIDS conference. Thank you very much.
Ralph Juergens is co-founder of the Canadian HIV-AIDS Legal Network and most recently has been a senior advisor to the Global Fund to Fight AIDS, Tuberculosis, and Malaria. His presentation at the 2010 International AIDS Conference in Vienna was called People Who Use Drugs, HIV, and Human Rights.
People First Radio is an initiative of Columbian Centre Society in partnership with Radio Malaspina Society's CHLY 101.7 FM, chly.ca, community radio from Nanaimo, British Columbia. The opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily of these organizations.